Hello and welcome back. At the end of the last lecture, a question came up about the nature of the licensing that would have to occur so as to ruin the small entity status for an applicant that would otherwise have qualified as a small entity. Does that license need to be an exclusive license, or could a mere non-exclusive license be sufficient to ruin the small entity status of the owner of the patent application? This is an area that I'm not aware of having been litigated, and I'm pretty sure it has not been, beyond a few cases that have said, kind of in passing, district court cases that have not been appealed, that any license, even a non-exclusive, would be close enough to selling an invention that somebody would lose their small entity status. Clearly, to be on the safe side, to minimize the risk of something blowing up in your face later, to be on the safe side, you would just always pay the large entity fee in the U.S., just as the Canadian practitioners feel very strongly that to be on the safe side in Canada, you should pay the large entity fee. Another question that came up after the last lecture was, is the kind of selling that we're talking about for purposes of small entity the same kind of selling that we were talking about in the connection of statutory bars, Section 102 of the patent law? And no, they are two distinct kinds of selling. In the case of Section 102 of the patent law, the one that says that if you sold or offered for sale, if you sold your invention or offered it for sale almost a year ago, it means you've only got a few days left to file your U.S. patent application. The kind of selling we're talking about there is the patented product. If you've come up with a better mousetrap, then the way you get in trouble that way is by selling mousetraps and allowing almost a year to pass and then somehow not managing to file your patent application. That for statutory bar purposes, the kind of selling we're talking about is the article itself, the mousetrap. In contrast, the kind of selling that that we're talking about that ruins your small entity status is selling the invention itself, the legal rights to the invention. That if the invention itself is sold, or if the person promises to sell it or has promised to sell it to somebody who is not a small entity, then that is the kind of selling that we're talking about that ruins the small entity status. The typical example here, again, would be a situation where a company has employees and where the employee, on their first day of work, they were made to sign a patent agreement that said that if they invent anything while they're working at the company, that the invention goes over to their employer, that ownership of the invention will go to the employer. That kind of promise is the kind of promise that many, many people make on their first day of work, working in an engineering firm or a scientific research institute or something, that or manufacturing firm, that that on the first day of work somebody signs something promising that they will give their rights over to the company if they invent anything. That is the very kind of agreement that counts as promising to sell your invention, and it means that there's no way that a big company can somehow get a cheap shot and not have to pay all their fees. Why? Because they'll just be sneaky and let their employees file individually. No, that won't work. If those employees were under an obligation that sooner or later they were going to have to give the rights over to their company, that very obligation is enough to make it to where the large or small status of the company, not the individual, is what will control whether you qualify as a large or small entity. So, as I said, we will now turn to the oath or declaration of the inventor. First, I should mention that in many countries around the world, there is nothing like this oath or declaration. We will spend quite a bit of time talking about this oath or declaration filed in the U.S. Patent Office. And the fact is that in many countries around the world, there's nothing like that, no requirement that's even close. In many countries around the world, the entity that applies for the patent is simply the employer, the company, the research institute, the engineering firm, the manufacturer. They simply file the patent application and that's it. Maybe they go ahead and say who the inventors are, but if they do, it's not like anybody is expecting the inventors to do any particular thing in connection with this patent application. But in the United States, by statute, by law, there is a very strict requirement that the actual people who are the inventors must provide an oath or declaration of inventorship. That whoever the inventor is, whoever the inventors are, their signatures are required. And if those signatures are not provided, the Office of Patent Application Processing will not release that application to the examining core. They will sit on it, and if that signature requirement is not satisfied quickly enough, if it's not satisfied on time, the application will go abandoned and it will never reach the examining core. It will never actually reach the part of the patent office whose job it is to decide whether they think that application is patentable or unpatentable. So let's talk about this oath or declaration. The oath or declaration is, first of all, either an oath or it's a declaration. What is an oath? An oath, for our purposes today, is a statement that is sworn before somebody who is authorized to administer oaths, by somebody who is able to ask the person to raise their hand and to swear that certain things are true. Who does that? Well, in the United States, that is almost always a notary public. So if your inventors are located in the United States, they could probably get in a car and drive somewhere and find a notary public, and they could take this oath document and stand in front of the notary and swear, raise their hand, and swear to the truth of what's in the document, and then the notary will notarize the document, put a seal on it and a stamp and a signature that makes very, very clear that it was sworn to before the notary. And when all that's done, we say we have an oath of the inventor. If there are multiple inventors, well, then they all each have to find a notary and sign papers in front of that notary. Once you get outside of the United States, there are some countries where there are no notaries. There are some countries where there are people whose job description is that they call themselves a notary, but it doesn't really work out to the same thing that we're used to in the United States. There are many countries where the only place you can find a notary is the United States Consulate or United States Embassy. There are countries where if you need to sign something in front of a notary, you pretty much better get in a car or a train and go to the capital of the country and go to the U.S. Embassy and stand in line, and eventually you get to stand in front of a notary and swear whatever it is that has to be sworn. Over the years, the U.S. patent law eventually evolved to attempt to accommodate this little pesky problem, which is that sometimes your inventor may be located in a place where there aren't any notaries. Or, even if they're in a place where there's lots of notaries, you might be signing it at 2 o'clock in the morning when all the places where you might go where there might be a notary are closed. A lot of people go to a bank to get something notarized. Well, most banks are not open at 2 o'clock in the morning. So, U.S. law, about 100 years ago, changed to accommodate a slightly different approach that does not require being in front of a notary. That approach is called the declaration approach. Declaration means that there are magic words, special words prescribed by statute. And if those words are in the document, then the person who signs it is understood to have accomplished the same results legally as would have been accomplished if they went and found a notary and swore to the truth of all this in front of a notary. The magic words involve penalty of perjury. The idea being that if the person signs it and it turns out later that it wasn't true, that they understand they might be sent away to prison for saying something that wasn't true. The exact words are words that you would need to copy very carefully from the statute if you were going to do this in your word processor. Fortunately, the declaration of inventorship that you would use for a U.S. patent can be done by means of a standardized form that is on the website of the Patent Office. And if you use the standardized form, it contains the magic words. And this saves you from having to worry about whether you correctly copied all those magic words into your word processor or something. So the standard form from the website of the Patent Office will contain the declaration language, the magic words. Of course, a declaration is much, much more convenient as compared to an oath when your inventors are located outside of the United States. If your inventors are in a place where there aren't very many notaries or no notaries at all, the declaration is much more convenient. Now, as it turns out, one of the requirements for a full patent application, the sort of long list of things that need to be in the envelope, is that you have to spill the beans on who the inventor is or who the inventors are. There are some foreign countries where that is not a requirement, where if you fail to say who the inventors are or you don't list them all, it just isn't as big a problem as it is in the United States. But in the United States, it's a big, big thing. You have to spill the beans on who the inventors are. Years ago, that was a requirement even for the shortlist. Years ago, just to get a filing date, you had to come up with the answer to the question of who's the inventor or who are the inventors. That changed some years ago, and as of right now, the list of the inventors is not on the short list. It is only on the long list. But you have to say who the inventors are. Then what? Then you have to say the city and state where each inventor resides. Or if they reside in a foreign country, you have to identify the city and country where the inventor resides. And if you have failed to provide that information, then it means you flunked the long list. And it means you're going to get a notice of missing parts, because they're going to say that you have to go and find out where each inventor resides and give that information to the patent office in an appropriate form. In addition, the law requires that you state the citizenship of each inventor, what country they are a citizen of. Above and beyond that, you have to give the country of which in which they reside. Now, this sort of is built into the idea of revealing the city and state where they live. Well, then you know it's the United States. Or if it's a city and country, well, then you know the country, because that was included there. But you have to provide the citizenship of each inventor. Finally, you are obligated to provide a mailing address for each inventor, postal address. Now, very often the postal address will just be a repeat of what we said before, namely the residence, city, and state. But there is no reason that they have to be a repeat. You could imagine an inventor who, for reasons of personal privacy, would prefer that the world not know exactly where they live. An inventor who might prefer that people not know where they go to sleep at night. Who might not want a stalker to be able to stalk them and follow them home. Who would not want people to be able to harass them by coming around to their house. That would be a perfectly understandable reason why an inventor might choose to give a postal address that is not the same as where they live. Again, the patent law requires that the residence, city, and state be revealed for each inventor, but you do not have to reveal where in that city they actually live. One patent where I'm an inventor applied for at a time when I was living here in Summit County, Colorado, and my residence then was not in any city or town. It was only in Summit County. Well, in that application, it was necessary to list me as being in Summit County, Colorado. So there you have an example where even there isn't even a town or city listed. But anyway, there has to be a postal address, and it is not required that the postal address be the place where that person sleeps at night. It does not have to be their residential address. The oath or declaration is required to contain language in which the inventor or inventors set forth what filings, if any, they have done in foreign countries on the same invention. Indeed, they have to list separately those things they filed in foreign countries that were more than a year ago and those things they filed in foreign countries that were within the last year. You can guess where this is coming from. Where it comes from is the Paris Convention that I mentioned earlier, that there's a one-year period that says that if you filed in a foreign country and later you file in the U.S., and if you do it within 1 year, then you will get credit in the U.S. for having filed on the day that you first filed in the foreign country. That only works if it's within a year. It turns out, we haven't talked about this yet, it turns out that if you filed in a foreign country more than a year before, then that spoils it, and you no longer get this benefit under the Paris Convention. Well, the requirement for the oath or declaration includes a positive burden on the applicant that they must reveal to the Patent Office what foreign filings, if any, they have done, including the ones that were more than a year in the past. Rules also require that the oath or declaration include language in which the inventor acknowledges a duty to disclose relevant prior art to the patent office. We will talk about that later at great length, the things that you actually do before the patent office in an effort to fulfill your duty to disclose known relevant prior art to the patent office. But in any event, the oath or declaration is required to contain language in which the inventor or inventors acknowledge that they have a duty to disclose relevant prior art to the patent office. The oath or declaration is required to contain language that says that the inventor has read the patent application, including the claims, and understands them. And the inventor is further obligated to say that he or she believes that he or she is the first and true inventor thereof, or if there are several of them, that they believe together that between them they are the first and true inventors of whatever it is that we're talking about. These are all magic words that have to be in the oath or declaration. Now, the thing about all those magic words that have to be there is that if you use the standard form from the website of the Patent Office, it won't surprise you when I say the standard form contains all these magic words. So you simply use that form, and then you don't have to wonder, did I make any kind of mistake when I was copying, pasting into my word processor program or something. There are patent firms that will use an oath or declaration of their own design that they build in their word processor, putting in all the things they think would be good to have in the oath or declaration. And when they do that, they're in a position of constantly wanting to check and make sure that they do contain all the magic words, that they do include all the magic words that are required of an oath or declaration. Duty to disclose. They have read the specification and the claims. They understand them. They believe they are the first and true inventor thereof. That they have disclosed all the foreign filings, if any, that are relevant to this patent application. That everything about the oath or declaration is being signed under penalty of perjury, at least the declaration, and then they sign it. All these things have to be in the oath or declaration. Now, the rules for oaths and declarations permit either of two approaches, two paths for how to collect the signatures. One possibility is to have an oath or declaration that contains everything I just said. Names of the inventors, citizenship, postal address, residence, city and state, residence, country, and all these other things like the disclosure of what the previous filings were in the foreign countries. All those things could be in a single document. And if they are, well, then that's one of the ways to fulfill that part of the long list, that part of what you have to do to avoid a notice of missing parts. That's one approach. The other approach is called the application data sheet approach. You can use what is called a short form declaration. The short form declaration contains only a few things, only a few magic words. And almost everything else is communicated to the U.S. Patent Office in a very different way, not through the declaration. All the other things are communicated through what is called an application data sheet. Now, what is in the short form declaration? The short form declaration only contains magic words, such as the statement that it's under penalty of perjury, acknowledging the duty of disclosure, stating that the inventor has read the application, including the claims, understands them, that the inventor believes that he or she is the first and true inventor thereof, and then it just asks for their signature and their name and their country of citizenship and nothing else. It's a fairly short form. There is a standard form on the website of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office that contains the short form language. That form says Declaration of Inventorship for Use with an Application Data Sheet. That's the title. So you'll see the phrase application data sheet in the title, and that tells you that that's the form you want to use. The application data sheet then contains everything else that I mentioned before. The application data sheet contains the list of foreign filings, if any, that came before this, filings in foreign countries. The application data sheet contains the postal addresses of the inventors. It contains the residence, city, and state of each of the inventors. And so on. It contains some other things as well. There are advantages and disadvantages to using either the long form declaration, the one that contains everything, on the one hand, or using the short form declaration, which contains almost nothing other than what is minimally necessary, the short form declaration being the kind where you then submit a separate application data sheet that answers all the other questions that were not answered in the short form declaration. But to circle back around and to remind ourselves why we care about this, it is that the U.S. Patent Office, by law, is required to make us provide signatures of each of the inventors. Those signatures need to be there, and when those signatures are provided, then the Office of Patent Application Processing will eventually pass the application on to the examining corps. But if the signatures are missing, they will sit on it and they will never release it to the examining corps. The oath or declaration can be either a short form declaration or it can be a long form. What are the pros and cons? In my office, our routine practice is to use the short form declaration. We use the short form declaration because you send it to the inventor signs it. There aren't very many pieces of information in that form. Hopefully we can get it right on the first try, fill in the blanks correctly, and the inventor won't see any reason to change anything in that form. And it's simple, and it's one page long. And then we have all the time in the world to play around with the application data sheet and make sure we fill in the blanks and get the answers to those various questions. And if the application data sheet turned out to have a mistake in it, you are permitted to submit the changes later to bring everything up to date or to correct anything that was incorrect. But you don't have to go back to the inventor and get them to sign a whole new form. That's if you use the short form declaration. In contrast, if you use the long form declaration, the one that lists all kinds of information, including the postal address and the resident city and state and all these things where you talk about the previous foreign filings and so on, if all that is in the declaration, well, then you'll have an inventor who feels compelled to read the whole thing. And next thing you know, they'll find things that they think are wrong, and it'll slow down the whole process. Or maybe they'll just cross stuff out and change it to be something else and then send it to you. And then you're in a position where it's useless to you because it's been modified under circumstances where the Patent Office is not going to trust the modifications. I'll talk about that in a minute. The long-form declaration has the further problem that if even the tiniest thing turns out to have been in error, you may well have to run back and get another round of signatures from the inventors to address whatever the error or errors might have been. So it's the long form declaration, in our experience, is more trouble than it's worth. We prefer the application data sheet approach. Okay, I mentioned a moment ago that the Patent Office might not trust the form if it has changes on it, and now we have to talk about that. The U.S. Patent Office is very picky about declarations and oaths. If they see it signed by the inventor or the inventors, and if they also see places where people cross things out or change something or interlineated some new language or something, they'll announce that the oath or declaration is defective. And they'll refuse to take it, and they'll say, now go back and get a new set of signatures. And this time, if you felt like something needed to be changed, you better change it before they sign it. This is a pain in the neck. It's a pain in the neck for a lot of reasons. For one thing, you already got the signatures from the inventors, and now a month or two later you got to go back and ask them to sign something again. It might annoy them. They might dislike being interrupted. They may be very busy and not have time for stuff like this. Or they may be dead. Or they work for some company and now they've been fired. They don't work there anymore. Or any of dozens of other things that might happen that make it either unpleasant or impossible to get fresh signatures from the inventors. Could be a big problem. So wouldn't it be nice to pick an approach that will probably work on the first try and is very unlikely to leave you in a position where you feel like you have to go back and get more signatures? For that, the short form declaration is a better choice as compared to the long form. because there isn't as much to go wrong in the shorter form. It just does not have as much information on it. Now, one of the things that that occasionally comes up is that you'll file something called a continuation or divisional application, which we have not talked about yet, but we will talk about later. If you file a so-called continuation or divisional application, that is an application that is related in a very close way to some previous U.S. application. And the oath or declaration from the previous application can probably be reused in the continuation or divisional application. I will simply mention that briefly now, and in real life, if you end up handling a continuation or divisional application, it's to your advantage to keep this in mind that you may be able to simply recycle or reuse the previous oath or declaration out of a previous case. At this point, we simply have to acknowledge, as I did a moment ago, that sometimes inventors turn out to be dead or they got fired. And for one reason or another, it may be a real challenge getting their signature on the oath or declaration of inventorship. The procedures of the U.S. Patent Office are designed to give you a couple of ways to deal with this problem. If the inventor is dead, you get things signed by the administrator or administratrix of their estate, or the executor or executrix of their estate. One of the patents where my father is an inventor is a patent where the application was filed after my father had died, and my mother signed the patent application. She signed the declaration. So that's one of the things that sometimes happens, is that you have an inventor who is unable to sign because they're dead. Another possibility is that the inventor will be unable to sign because they are incapacitated. They're in the hospital, they're in a coma, they are not responsive to stimuli, and yet they are not dead. Well, then you arrange for their legal representative to sign the papers. Suppose the problem simply is that the inventor refuses to sign. You've asked them, and they say no. Why might they do that? Well, what happens in real life, over and over again, is that you'll run into an inventor who was fired last week. And they don't like the fact that they were fired. They hate the fact that they were fired. And they say to themselves, that's the last time I'm ever doing anything for my former employer. I'm not going to sign papers now. They fired me. I'm not going to do them any favors at all. Well, if that happens, there is a procedure you can follow. We won't spend a lot of time on it here, but there is a procedure. You essentially file what is called a Rule 47 petition. You set forth the details that you did ask them. They knew that they were being asked to sign a patent application. They refused to sign it. They knew that what they were refusing to sign was a patent application. And you reveal their last known address in these papers to the Patent Office. And if the petition is granted, then the USPTO will allow the application to go to the examining corps despite the fact that we don't have a signature from the unwilling inventor. Yet another possibility is the case where the inventor simply cannot be found. They invented it, and now we don't know where they are. We haven't heard from them. We can't find them. If that happens, there is a particular petition you can fill out. And you explain to the Patent Office that you don't know where they are. You say, here's the last known address. And you pay a fee. And if they grant the petition, then the application will be released from OPAP, and it will go to the examining corps. So there are procedures that can be followed that will allow you to deal with the challenge that sometimes comes up, the challenge which is that sometimes you are unable to get all the signatures from all the inventors. Now, the question of what it takes to get the application released from the Office of Patent Application Processing and sent over to the examining corps is not the same question as who owns the patent application. And that question we will talk about in the next lecture.